This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Killed, written by Thomas Enger, performed by David Shaw Parker. Prologue. The body lying at Henning Yule's feet in the bottom of the boat was wrapped in two industrial rubbish bags. They had been pulled over at the head and the feet and were sealed by several meters of silver-gray tape. Henning tried not to think about the person inside. Instead, he looked at the mist drifting in over the still dark water, eerie wisps of white that seemed to reach out towards the shore. All he could hear were the oars breaking the surface and the drops of water that ran off the blades as the man in front of him lifted and lowered them. A pungent smell made Henning wonder if perhaps the lake had swallowed something old and rotten, and was struggling to digest it. Henning liked water, but he didn't like forest lakes like this. They could hide anything, whatever his imagination might stretch to, and soon he would lie hidden here too. The boat glided slowly over the water. Henning looked at the man in front of him, at his short, messy hair, the ripple of his arm muscles. Durim Redzepi had been hunting him for a long time. Now, finally, he would be able to finish the job he'd been given. It had been a long and strenuous journey to get to this point. When Henning looked back at all the events that had unfolded, he knew that all of them had occurred because he had chosen to return to work 2 years after the fire in which his son Jonas was killed. By doing so, by investigating the Henriette Hagerup case, Henning had managed to turn the spotlight on his own scarred face, and Toru Pulli had been alerted to the fact that Henning was back in business as an investigative journalist. Pulli, a former muscle-for-hire-turned real estate broker, was serving 14 years in prison for a murder he didn't commit. Desperate to clear his name, he had reached out to Henning, claiming to know the people responsible for Jonas's death. If Henning would help him, he had said, if Henning would find the real killer and clear Pulley's name, he would then disclose what he knew about the fire. Of course, he jumped at the chance, Henning mused. Why wouldn't he? But Pulley was killed in jail before Henning could meet his end of the bargain, and before Pulley had revealed the miserable secret he was harboring. But the floodgates had been opened. What Henning had suspected all along had been correct. Someone had set fire to his apartment. He was going to get to the bottom of it all, no matter what, without Pulley's help. And despite the fact that memory loss meant Henning couldn't recall the stories he had been following in the weeks leading up to that fateful day. He'd worked with all the tunnel vision of a bereaved parent. Henning could see that now. He had finally managed to find an interview he had conducted in those weeks with a carpenter who had been working for Charlie Highseether, a friend of Pulley's in the Brazilian real estate business. This carpenter, Rasmus Bjelland, had fled Brazil following a police operation that had led to the arrest of several hard-hitting Norwegian gang members who were laundering their drug money through apartment businesses in the Brazilian seaside city of Natal. These thugs were convinced it was Bjelland who had provided the cops with key information about their operations, and a price was put on his head. Henning managed to track the carpenter down, but in the interview, Bjelland had maintained his innocence. Even now, Henning could clearly remember believing him, and that was one of the points at which his investigation changed. The carpenter also told Henning that if he dug a little deeper into Toru Pulley's past, he might just find out that he still had at least 1 foot in the criminal world. "Go back to the 1990s, Bjellin told Henning. "Then you'll see what kind of transactions Pulley was involved in when he first started to make a name for himself in real estate." The bit firmly between his teeth, the truth of his boy's death within reach but still obscured, Henning was impelled to follow every lead, to rattle every cage, to put himself at risk. And he didn't regret one single moment of that investigation. When he discovered that Pulley had been sitting in a car outside Henning's apartment for 3 nights in a row before the day of the fatal fire, taking pictures and monitoring Henning's movements, he became certain that it was Pulley's business partners who were trying to prevent him from digging into the truth about Bjelland, the real estate business in Brazil, the drugs money, and much, much more. But it seemed these associates of Pulley would go to any lengths to silence anyone they thought might expose them. Not only was Pulley killed in prison, but a police report about Pulley's actions on the night of the fire had also been altered by someone with access to the classified records. And Jurim Redzepi, the very man now sitting in front of Henning in the boat, had been hired to track Henning down and to end his life once and for all. After narrowly dodging 2 attempts on his life, Henning continued his quest with ever greater intensity, knowing that time was working against him. He had been unable to give up, driven by memories and love for his dead son. He hung his head, putting together the pieces that had led him to this boat. Pulley's widow, Veronica Nansen, had supported his quest and alerted him to another childhood friend of Pulley's, William Helberg, also a highly successful real estate broker. After Henning and his ex-wife Nora had managed to find William's missing sister, Hedda, William, as a way of saying thank you, disclosed that Pulley had broken Charlie Highseether's jaw during a fight about an apartment in Natal, and that the two of them were no longer friends. The details provided by Helberg made Henning certain that Highseether was the man behind it all, that there were secrets in his life so dark, deep, and dangerous, he would stop at nothing to protect them, including killing his old friend and business partner, Pulley. Henning had even believed that his own sister, Trina, had been involved in this tragic story, as Tora Pulley had taken a photograph of her outside Henning's apartment on the night of the fire, handing something over to Jurim Redzepi. All of this felt like a lifetime ago, Henning thought to himself. But it had, in fact, all happened within the space of a short summer, just a few crazy weeks, and that was enough to bring him here, to his certain death. During the last few hours, everything had changed, and now he was reconciled to his fate. He was convinced he could now die satisfied. His quest was over. He finally had the answers he'd been looking for. None of them would bring Jonas back. None of them would take away the pain that lingered in his chest. Everything that meant anything to him belonged to the past now. The years he'd been a father, the years he'd been allowed to love Nora, the years she'd loved him. Still, it was hard to let go, he thought, as the boat slid over the surface of the lake. He wondered if it would hurt, how it would all happen in the end. No matter what, Henning told himself, die silently. Die with dignity. Don't show him you're afraid. Redzepi took a few strokes with just one oar, the other resting, so the boat turned round. Then it stood still, the water lapping quietly at the prow. He pulled the oars in and got a hold of the body. He lifted it as though it weighed nothing and threw it overboard like a bag of rubbish. A heavy weight was attached to the body by a thick, rust-colored rope. Red Zeppi dropped it into the water, and the black plastic bundle immediately disappeared from sight. Red Zeppi, businesslike and calm, then grabbed the rope coiled at his feet and started to tie a noose. He went to the back of the boat, pulled a grey concrete block from under a white tarpaulin, and put it down in front of him. There was a thick blue handle cast in the concrete. Red Zeppi fed the rope through it, then, without a single word, attached it to Henning's right ankle. It all seemed so simple, so practical, and Henning wondered if he should put up a fight. But his shoulder still ached. How on earth was he going to overcome a man with a knife and a gun? Red Zeppi lifted the concrete block over the edge of the boat and dropped it into the water. The dull splash broke the silence that covered the lake like a blanket. The rope vanished quickly into the depths, as though strong hands were pulling it from below. Then Red Zeppi put his feet on what was left of the coiled rope at the bottom of the boat, and stood up.
"Your turn,"
he said, as if they were playing some kind of game. Henning tried to stand up, but his legs wouldn't do as they were told. He couldn't feel them, couldn't feel his feet in his shoes, the fabric of his trousers against his thighs.
"Come on, I haven't got all day,"
said Red Zeppi, then casually pulled out a gun and pointed it at Henning. He made a get-up gesture. Henning nodded and tried to push himself up. He succeeded this time, but the sudden movement made the boat rock. Henning had to step forwards to regain his balance. He took a deep breath and looked up again. It was hard to see anything. The mist had come down now, obscuring the shore. It had to be 30 meters or more to land. He cocked his head, thinking he heard something, a splash or something moving in the water. But it was nothing. There were no cars approaching, no branches snapping in the forest, no shouts that might bring a different fate from the one that was now so unavoidable. Henning put a foot on the edge of the boat and made sure he was steady, even though the vessel rocked a little again. The surface of the water in front of him was glossy, a thick, cold oil slick. The rope pulled down into it like a fishing line, heavy with new catch. He jumped. He held his breath, and as soon as he felt the cold water envelop him, he started to kick, trying to push his way up. But the weight was pulling him down. He mustered all the strength he could and kicked hard with his legs. They surprised him by doing what he wanted them to. He managed to slow his descent. Then, centimeter by centimeter, he used his good arm to thrust his way back up. He broke the surface of the water with a gasp. He blinked furiously and gulped down air, trying to orient himself as he paddled and kicked and thrashed with one arm, not sure that he'd be able to withstand the pull of the weight that was dragging him downwards. Henning stretched his neck and tried to breathe at the same time. Then he found himself looking at the boat. He saw Red Zeppi lift his gun and aim, and it dawned on him that this man didn't need to worry about blood or any traces of Henning anymore. In no more than a few seconds, the muzzle of the gun would flash, and Henning's head would explode. He pictured Nora's smile, her beautiful face, the shine of her short hair, her voice that made his body tingle, the warmth of her hands, how small they were. He thought about Ivor, and about Trina, about them playing in the water together at the cabin in Stavern, seeing who could hold their breath the longest. And that was when he suddenly stopped kicking and let the water wrap round him like a shroud. He knew that no personal best time would help him now, that no one, nothing, could save him, and that he would rather die on his own terms. That's why he closed his eyes and let himself slowly sink down into the cold, black nothingness. Chapter 1, January 1996. Had it not been for the snow, it would have been pitch dark. The cars were tightly parked along the edge of the pavement, and the buildings towered into the sky. The streetlights had either been turned off or were not working. If she hadn't lived there for over 50 years, Bodil Svenkerud might have been afraid. A lot went on after dark on the streets of Oslo these days. But not in Eckersbergsgate. She had never been afraid of anything there. And now she just wanted to get home and have a lovely cup of hot tea. It had been a long day. Mrs. Svenkerud urged her legs to keep moving on the soft snow. It was a disgrace that the roads and pavements weren't cleared sooner and more often. She had the feeling they always left her street until last. The slippery, dry powder snow had brought her more or less to a standstill. That was why, when she spotted a gap between two parked cars, she went out into the middle of the road. After all, it was her street, having checked both ways first. She saw a car coming slowly towards her, but it was still some distance away. She had time, she reckoned, before the car got close, and even though she could feel there was ice under the snow, it was still easier to walk in the tire tracks. Mrs. Svenkerud pulled her fur coat tighter, looked up at the building that was in front of her on the right, where she had lived for so long. This was where they had had their wedding party in 1957. They couldn't afford anything else. This was where they had had their children, and later played with their grandchildren, whose life had raced by like a high-speed train. This was where the cancer cells had invaded Olav Sebastian's body and reduced him to a morose, sick shadow of the great man he'd once been. A man who'd engaged in local politics, who'd run 8 kilometers 3 nights a week, even when he was over 70, and who'd loved going for walks in Frogner Park on Sundays, especially when pushing little Sophus in his pram. This was where he'd said his final goodbye, one beautiful late summer day in 1992. There were lights on in some of the windows up on the third floor. So they'd started already, the joiners. But she was not going to let anyone force her out. She most certainly was not. That was what she'd told the young advisor in Oslo Council as well, the one who hadn't had time for her at first, but then had managed to squeeze in 15 minutes at the end of the day. The beautiful girl with the dark hair, what was her name again? Had promised to take up her case as soon as she got to work in the morning. Were there no limits to how shameless people could be these days? Mrs. Svenkerud pressed on and swung her arms to help her move faster. She was getting warm, and a thin layer of condensation had formed on the inside of her spectacles. She could just make out the crossing about 30 meters in front of her. She looked back. The car was much closer now. Mrs. Svenkerud tried to walk faster, but the snow was so loose and soft that it was hard to get a firm footing. She almost lost her balance, but fortunately managed to stay on her feet. She looked round again. The car seemed to have speeded up. Surely the driver had seen her, with all the safety reflectors she was wearing. She tried to wave at him. But the driver didn't slow down. In fact, he did the opposite. And that was when she realized the car was going to knock her down. She made a last-ditch attempt to get out of the way, but the ice was deceptive and slippery under her winter boots, and she didn't manage to move before the car hit her side-on, throwing her up onto the bonnet. Her back was to the windscreen, and she was forced up onto the roof, where she lay still for a brief second before the winter tires bit into the ice as the wheels locked. She was thrown forward onto the bonnet again, and then rolled down onto the road, where she landed with her face in the soft, cold snow. She couldn't move, though strangely enough, it didn't hurt. It was as though her whole body had been numbed. But she was bleeding from a cut on her forehead, and soon the whole side of her face was warm. The impact had also damaged one of the buttons on her hearing aid, and it was whining loudly, piercing her eardrum. Mrs. Svenkerud managed to haul herself up onto her knees. She felt the cold and damp seep through her trousers and long johns. She lifted her head and straightened her glasses, turned around and squinted at the car with its engine still running. She hadn't noticed until now, but in the beam from the headlights, she saw that big white flakes had started to fall again. Why didn't the driver get out to help her? The car reversed a few meters, then headed for her again. She couldn't get out of its way. She knew she wouldn't make it in time, even though the studded tires were spinning on the ice and snow. Shouting wouldn't help. She braced herself for the pain, and when it came, it was intense and paralyzing. The weight and speed of the car made her skid across the road until she stopped close to the curb. And there she lay, unable to move, while cold, white kisses melted on her burning cheeks. The glass in her spectacles was smashed, and she could barely see. Fortunately, the ringing in her ears stopped and was replaced by silence, bringing with it a diamond-like certainty. She knew what this was about. There was no doubt about it. She only hoped that the bright, helpful girl at Oslo Council, what was her name again, would realize as well. That she would hear about this and do something. Trina, Mrs. Svenkerud remembered as the car headed towards her again. The girl in the council offices was called Trina. Trina Yul. Chapter 2, October 2009. The light seeped in through the white curtains and bathed the bed in a faint shimmer. The woman lying next to Charlie Highseether turned slightly and breathed in sleepily through her nose. "You're awake already," she said in a drowsy voice, her face against the pillow. "Hmm," he replied. The light paled her cheeks as she curled up in a ball and pulled the thin duvet tighter. She stretched out a warm hand and found Charlie's soft belly. "You always wake up so early," she mumbled.
"Hmm, you just go back to sleep."
The curtains in front of the open window billowed in the wind that blew tirelessly off the Atlantic Ocean. The sound of the constant traffic rose all the way up to the 15th floor from the street below. Isabel opened her eyes, brown and dark. Charlie felt her look at him, more awake than before.
"You were so restless last night," she said. "Were you dreaming?"
He shook his head.
"What was it then?"
"Nothing. You just go back to sleep."
The truth was that he'd barely slept at all. There was so much going on at the moment. Tore was dead. And that journalist kept phoning and leaving messages.
"Hi, I'd like to talk to you about Tore Pulley. Hi, I'd like to arrange a time when I can talk to you. Hi, would it be possible to have a few words about Rasmus Bjelland?"
No, it would not be possible. Not at all. And then there was the leisure complex they wanted to build, if only they could find the right place. But now that I'm awake, Isabel said and moved her hand, don't you think you should do something about it? She pressed her fingers a little harder against his stomach, just above the belly button, then moved down. But he barely reacted. Isabel pulled her hand back, turned onto her front, and cupped her chin in her palms.
Tired?
She asked affectionately.
Just a bit, Charlie said, grateful that she didn't make a drama out of it.
Instead, she snuck a hand over to his chest this time, stroked the hairs down, then up towards his neck, chin, gently tugged at the stubble there, and ran a more curious finger over his scar.
Don't,
he said, pulling his head back.
Sorry.
He pushed the duvet to one side and swung his feet down onto the cool, hard tiles on the floor, stood up, and walked naked over to the window, put his ear to his left shoulder, then the other to the right. There was a crack.
I'm sorry,
she said again.
It's fine. You just go back to sleep.
He lit up a cigarette and went out onto the terrace, where he was greeted by a clear blue sky. The floor tiles here were already warm and burned the soles of his feet. He leaned against the railings. The rare shower they'd had last night had dried up long ago. The smell of dusty asphalt and rubbish rose up from the street below. Charlie took a drag on the cigarette and looked out over the shining silver ocean. From a distance, it didn't look like the water was moving. It just lay there, glittering, apparently smooth. Soon, the beautiful wide beaches would start to fill up. Soon, the local boys would meet to play football, filled with the dream of becoming the new Neymar or Pele. People would buy chilled snowballs, chocolate and cigarettes, and lie dozing until the sun dipped down below the horizon again. This was Natal, Sun City. The average temperature here was 28 degrees Celsius, with 300 days of sun a year. The town had previously been home to both Indians and French pirates, this town that he had helped to develop, certainly in terms of sun-seeking Norwegians. It had all been a bit of an adventure, really. A dangerous one. They had played for high stakes, particularly in recent years. People had ended up in jail. Lives had been lost. But now, things were back to where they'd been when they started in the late 90s. The way Tora wanted things to be. Charlie looked over at the neighboring terrace. The flat was still empty. A few dried leaves had been blown all the way up here to the 15th floor. He must remember to send someone round to sweep them away before the next viewing. He always felt a stab of guilt whenever he thought that they could have been neighbors, Tore and him, and that they could have stood each other on their own side of the shoulder-high wall that divided the two terraces with an ice-cold beer in their hands, looking out over the ocean, while they reminisced about the good old days, when their bank accounts were filling up nicely and they partied practically every night. But too much had happened between them. Things had been said and done that couldn't be undone. Tora should perhaps still have got the flat. At the end of the day, he'd earned it. Charlie put a hand to his chin and felt the scar that Tora had given him, looked down at the street, and sucked in some more nicotine. A man was out running, his bare chest already gleaming in the morning sun. Old cars, discolored by sand and rust, sped by. Charlie's eyes fixed on a dark Audi that was parked in the shade of a palm tree. The same car that had been in the same place every morning for the past few days. From up here, it was impossible to tell if anyone was sitting inside, and it was always gone by the time Charlie came down to start his day. But he decided he'd get Freddy to check it out. Charlie stubbed his cigarette against the wall and flicked it out over the railing. He watched it fall, slowly, down towards the street, until it was caught by a gust of wind and blown onto another terrace. He went into his enormous flat, where the walls were as naked as the woman in his bed, who raised herself up onto her elbows. The duvet still covered her stomach, slim hips and legs.
"Hi,"
she said, and brushed a long curl of black hair from her eyes.
"Hi,"
he said. Charlie pulled on a pair of shorts and some sandals.
"What's up?"
she asked.
"Nothing."
"Are you sure? You're so distant these days."
"I'm gonna make coffee," he said.
"Do you want some?" She pushed the duvet aside, revealing a suntanned body. Charlie didn't look at her, nor did he get an answer. A few moments later, he was in the kitchen.
"I wouldn't mind a cup of tea,"
she called after him. Charlie had met Isabel in the bar at Praia dos Artistas. She'd sent him stolen glances all evening, and when she later came over and said in her broken Brazilian English that she was a dancer and she'd like to show him what she could do, but preferably somewhere else, he'd just assumed she was a prostitute. But she was in fact looking for a job, and when she told him her name was Claudia Isabel Ipiranga, "but everyone calls me Isabel," he turned and studied her dark skin, the Indian features, her long, slender body. He'd seen the need in her eyes and wondered what poverty she'd suffered in the course of her barely 25 years. But most of all, he had seen who she looked like, and he'd felt a strange and rare need to be kind. That was 5 months ago. Now, she danced at Senzuela 6 nights a week, and then came home to him. To begin with, everything had been fine. For a while, he'd even thought he might fall in love with her. But then one day he'd admitted to himself that she would never be Mariana. He'd been thinking of ending the relationship for a while, but hadn't managed to do it. He liked her, after all. Appreciated her company and gorgeous body as long as she didn't do anything stupid, like get pregnant. He presumed he'd miss her if she wasn't there, and he liked the thought that he'd saved her from, well, something. He'd never really asked about her life up to that point, what she'd done. Perhaps he should. Charlie took a cup of chai latte back into the bedroom. He'd made it just the way he knew she liked it.
"Thank you," she said. "You're so good to me."
"If only you knew," Charlie thought, as he pulled on a white T-shirt that stretched tight over his belly. He noticed her watching him over the edge of the cup.
"So, what's happening today?"
she asked in a bright, expectant voice. Charlie took a deep breath, which he released as a long sigh.
"Exactly the same as yesterday," he replied.
The dark Audi was gone when Charlie emerged onto the pavement. Instead, Freddy was standing there waiting in his usual jeans, T-shirt and light brown linen blazer. Freddy was actually called Fred Ari and was from Oslo, but had taken his muscles and gun with him to Natal. Everyone in town knew he was on Charlie's payroll, so not someone you wanted to cross. And no one tried, largely because of the gun that was always in its holster underneath his jacket.
"I want you to post a man under that palm tree over there," Charlie said and pointed. "There's been a black Audi in that parking space for the past 3 nights.
"Very good, boss."
"I want the driver's name and who he's working for, if anyone."
"Very good, boss."
Charlie looked around. Then he got into Freddy's car, a Mercedes CLS Grand Edition, and they sped off through the streets. It was impossible for Freddy to stick to the speed limit. It was against his nature. But it didn't matter because the police wouldn't dream of stopping them anyway.
So, where are we going? He asked.
The club first, Charlie said, and take an extra turn around the block before we get there.
Freddy glanced over at him, but said nothing. They drove through the town as it was starting to wake up. When they passed Juan's shop, someone came out carrying fruit, bread and drinks. A boy of around 9 or 10 had just got an inflatable killer whale and was tearing off the plastic packaging when his mother stopped him with a firm hand. They passed Pepe the fishmonger on his small ancient moped that spewed out black clouds of exhaust on his way to the harbour for the night's catch. Charlie liked this time of day, when it hadn't quite started yet and the temperature was bearable. It was still possible to get things done when you were up early in Natal. For the past few months, Charlie had been focused on drumming up funds for a new leisure centre where people could skate, bowl, play mini-golf, everything under one roof. There would be restaurants and shops there too. It would be unlike anything else in Natal. A recreational oasis. Several investors had already said that they wanted to be part of the project, but Charlie hadn't found the right place yet. He had seen a few good possibilities in the past couple of weeks, but so far none of the owners had been willing to sell. Charlie would continue to build residential complexes. It was clearly the best business in the area, but it was also smart to have more than one iron in the fire. 10 minutes later, they stopped outside a fitness club. Freddy went in first and scouted the place, then gave Charlie a nod. Charlie got out into the sunshine. Two women in their mid-30s walked slowly by. One of them turned to look at Charlie, then said something to her friend. Charlie automatically followed them with his eyes, assessed their shoes, ankles, legs, behinds, trying to ascertain if they'd bought their fuckability or if it was natural. A curtain twitched on the other side of the street. Freddy stepped out into the road and squared his shoulders. A car that was coming towards them braked. Charlie didn't even look at the driver, just carried on across the road and into the club. There he was met with bass rhythms, sparkling mirrors, and the thud of weights. Charlie walked through the gym without looking at any of the people who were there and straight into the office. A small cupboard of around 8 square meters that was in desperate need of a revamp, but Charlie didn't see the point. He liked the fact that there was paper everywhere, that there were cracks in the walls. It reminded him of the early days in Norway when he couldn't pay the bills before Heisi the property found its feet and then sprouted wings. The only thing that was a must was a top-end computer, and he was more than happy with his latest procurement, the fastest iMac model Apple had on the market. Charlie liked the contrast between the stylish 27-inch screen and the shabby room.
"There's a flight landing from Amsterdam at 19:35 this evening," he told Freddy when he'd shut the door. "I want you to collect one of the passengers."
Freddy smiled. He knew full well it wasn't the passenger that they needed to get out of the airport, but rather the money that was glued to his body.
"Shall I take Hanselman with me?"
"No."
"But he's the one who usually takes care of customs.
Charlie turned abruptly towards Freddy.
"I've got another job for Hanselman. You'll go alone."
Freddy hesitated for a moment, then he nodded.
"Anything else you want me to do today, boss?"
Charlie sighed.
"There's the Audi."
"Very good, boss. I'll get onto it right away."
And a few minutes later, Charlie was alone in the office. He looked at the clock. 4 o'clock in the morning in Norway. He wondered how everything was going at home. But it was too early to call Daddy Longlegs. Charlie leaned back in the chair, stared at the screen in front of him, which was currently black, saw his own reflection, the white hair, the blue eyes, the beard. He'd been sitting here exactly like this, when Mariana had come in for the first time. "Hi," she'd said. "My name is Mariana de la Rosa. You need an assistant."
"Do I?"
Charlie hadn't advertised for anyone at the time, but then he never did.
"Yes, you do," she replied. "Just looking round this office, I can see four things that need to be done immediately."
"Right."
He'd straightened up. "First of all, you've got all your appointments written down there." She'd pointed to the diary that was lying open in front of him. "No one uses them anymore."
"Really?"
"I can put all that information on your computer, and then you'll get a message on your mobile phone 10 minutes before you have to leave."
"Hmm,"
was his response, as he thought about it. "You also need a system for your receipts, invoices. They're all over the place. I can sort them out for you." Charlie had become increasingly curious about this tall, slim woman with jet black hair and a slightly pointy chin, and not just because she had brown eyes that tempted him like an advert for caramel chocolate, but also because there was a resoluteness about her. She had opinions, and he realized she wasn't afraid to wear them.
"You're a man who can't tidy up after himself," she'd continued.
"Am I?"
She'd pointed at the two coffee cups on the table, both stained black. There was a plate by his mouse with a scrunched-up baguette bag, an empty cigarette packet, an ashtray full to the brim with ash and stubs.
"I'm good at tidying."
Then she'd stopped talking and just stood there looking at him.
"But you're not very good at counting," he pointed out.
"Sorry?"
"You said there were four things you could help me with."
"Oh."
Then she'd smiled for the first time, and her whole face had changed, opened. This person whom he'd initially thought was quite hard and angular now revealed a playful side.
"I forgot. Your T-shirt," she said, pointed at what he was wearing. Charlie had looked down at his belly. "You should keep a couple here in a drawer," she said. "In case."
Then she stopped herself and lowered her eyes. "Sorry," she said. "It's none of my business to..."
"Not at all,"
Charlie assured her.
"You're right. Spaghetti sauce stains don't look good when you're meeting clients."
She looked up at him again and flashed another smile. She had started the following day, Mariana de la Rosa, and stayed with him for just over 3 years, until she found love. Until she was killed. And even though Charlie hadn't attached the explosives to her car, he should have known what might happen. And that was what haunted him at night. Chapter 3. Henning Yule stared at the screen in front of him, convinced that it couldn't be right. But when he checked the date and time again, there was no doubt. Trina, his own sister, had been outside the building where he lived only 10 minutes before Jonas died. She had given something to Durim Redzepi, a man Henning was sure had tried to kill him at least twice, and who he now also believed was responsible for setting fire to his home. Then she'd driven off. Henning understood why Veronica Nansen had insisted that he sit down before looking through the 213 photographs that her late husband, Tor Pulley, had taken in the 3 days before Jonas's death. It was hard to breathe, and Henning felt hot all over. He sat back and tried to think. How the hell would Trina know a guy like Redzepi, who was wanted for a double murder in his own country? And what had she given to him? "Are you okay?" Veronica Nansen's voice was cautious, but warm. "Stupid question, really," she corrected herself. "Is there anything I can do?" Henning leaned forward and took a sip of water from the glass she'd put down in front of him.
No, he replied. Not sure that there is.
He looked at the photograph of Trina again. What are you going to do? Veronica asked, and put a hand on his shoulder. Henning used the arm of his shirt to wipe the sweat from his face.
I don't know, he said.
At the same time, he thought about Trina, who was in the Bahamas right now, recuperating from the scandal that had forced her to step down as Minister of Justice.
I've got a suggestion, Veronica said, sitting up straight.
Let's go through everything that you know and think you know. Anything you're not sure about. She closed the laptop. I'm sure you've done it 100 times before, but let's go through it all again anyway. Maybe you'll get more out of it if you say it out loud to someone else. Henning had only ever discussed his case with 2 people before. Bjarne Brogeland and Ivar Gundersen. One was a policeman, and the other Nora's boyfriend and a fellow journalist at 123 News. Ivar, in particular, had tried to help him. Henning had even spent some nights on his sofa recently. Henning didn't really want to involve anyone else, but Veronica had, after all, found bits and pieces in Tora's belongings that had proved to be leads that progressed Henning's investigation. And now she'd found photographs that went a long way to proving Trina's involvement in the whole thing. Veronica had also shown herself to be a good sounding board. So Henning half turned towards her and said, I think it started with Rasmus Bjelland. For many years, Bjelland had worked as a carpenter for Charlie Highseether, one of Tora's old friends and business contacts, first in Norway and then in Natal, Brazil, after Charlie moved there in 1996. Together, they'd earned good money, building apartment complexes for sun-worshipping Norwegians, but many of those who had bought themselves a pied-à-terre in Natal were known criminals. Then, in 2007, a joint Norwegian-Brazilian police operation had resulted in a good number of them being arrested on charges of fraud and money laundering, and not long after, a rumor had started that it was Bjelland who had provided the police with the information that led to the arrests. A price was put on his head. Bjelland fled. As a crime journalist, Henning had heard about the conflict, and after a lot of digging, he had finally managed to get hold of Bjelland and get an interview. In the interview, Bjelland had claimed that he was not an informer, and had tipped Henning off that Tor Pulley, who had previously been one of Norway's most notorious enforcers, but had since gone on to become a very successful property developer, still had close ties with people in the criminal world. Tora's existence as a law-abiding businessman was apparently a facade, and Bjelland was certain that he was responsible for the loss of a number of lives. Henning had, without much success, tried to get Bjelland to expand on this claim.
Let me stop you right there, Veronica said.
Henning, who had been sitting staring at the table in front of him as he spoke, looked over at her. The skin on her face had taken on a reddish hue.
Basically, you're saying that Tora was still a criminal after he'd stopped being an enforcer? That he killed people?
Henning held up his hands.
That's what Bjelland claimed, he said, not me.
I lived with him for 5 years, Veronica snapped. I would have known if he was still breaking the law in some way.
Maybe, but if you look at the people around him, Veronica, the people he trained with, for example, there aren't many of them who would fall into the mummy's blue-eyed boy category. And is it really so hard to imagine that Tora may have been tempted to earn some extra money now and then? We both know that he had a gambling habit in the last years of his life.
Veronica didn't answer, but sat back in her chair and crossed her arms.
Henning could understand why she was so defensive. Tora had hung up his knuckle dusters long before he met her, and had been very successful in the property market throughout the 90s and into the noughties. But he had also kept his gambling secret from her, and he had not been 100% honest about his past as an enforcer.
I think that I'd started digging around based on Bjelland's tip-off just before the fire in my flat. She bristled.
So you think Tora had something to do with the fire in your flat? There was an offended sting to her voice. Henning wasn't sure if it was due to him or her dead husband. He shook his head and pointed at the computer.
Why was he sitting in a car only a few meters away taking photographs then? He asked. And before she could answer, I think maybe Tora had plans to do something, but then someone else beat him to it.
Who? Henning took a quick breath.
Charlie Highseater, possibly.
Bjelland said that I had to go back to the 90s, that I had to look at Tora's acquisitions, and that if I dug around a bit, I would find plenty of dirt. I didn't actually uncover much at the time, but I did find out later that Tora did a number of deals with Charlie Highseater around then, and that often the deals were done without the full details being reported to the Norwegian authorities. According to my source, they made an incredible amount of money for a while, and they were apparently without scruples.
Veronica's eyes were guarded.
Unscrupulous enough to take lives, you mean?
Henning shrugged. I don't know. What I do know is that Tora and Charlie were not on talking terms for the last year that Tora was alive, which could explain why they each had their own strategy for getting rid of me. Tora had one plan. He followed me to find out the best time to get me, whereas Charlie hired Durim Redzepi to do the job for him.
I'm a little confused, Henning. Do you mean that Tora or Charlie, or even both, were scared that you might discover something serious about them? An unsolved murder? Embezzlement? Money laundering? What are you actually saying?
I don't know, Henning said. For the moment, I'm just thinking out loud.
But why were you such a danger to them then?
Henning had asked himself the same question many times in recent months. Veronica continued before he could say anything. Everyone knows that when a journalist is killed, the media gives it even more attention. There's more pressure on the police, and they have to put in extra resources. It's an enormous risk to take, so I don't quite understand why they'd do that if you didn't know anything.
Not yet. No.
But I might find out.
Veronica sighed. The best thing, Henning thought, would be to talk to Rasmus Bjelland again. But no one had seen or heard of him for over 2 years now. It was quite possible that the death sentence he had hanging over him when Henning talked to him had been fulfilled.
But Bjelland worked closely with Charlie for years, he said, which might explain how he knew something about it.
But it doesn't explain why he would snitch on Tora.
No,
Henning said, picking up the glass of water again.
But I've got a theory about that.
He took a drink, turned a little, so his torso was facing her.
I think Bjelland wanted revenge.
Deep furrows appeared on Veronica's brow.
Revenge?
Henning nodded. He let this lie while Veronica processed it herself.
Why on earth would Bjelland want revenge on Tore?
I don't know yet, Henning admitted. But just think about it, he continued.
Why would he say something like that to me otherwise?
To be nice to me? To give me a scoop that would be printed in the paper?
He saw no answer in Veronica's eyes.
Bjelland and I had absolutely nothing to do with each other.
He had no reason to tip me off about anything,
Certainly not something as big as that, unless there was a purpose. He wanted to make life difficult for Tore.
Like I said, I don't know why, but can you think of any motive other than revenge?
When she didn't answer, Henning carried on. Just because the papers have written that you're not an informant doesn't make it any more valid or true. And Bjelland was perfectly aware of that. He also knew what kind of people were after him, as he'd spent more than a decade with them in Brazil. So, coming clean and being named and photographed in the paper was neither here nor there. They would be after him all the same.
Henning took another sip of water. Which is why I think he had a completely different agenda. He wanted me to start a process that he hoped would end with your husband going to jail.
Veronica shook her head.
That sounds totally far-fetched to me, she objected. As far as I know, they barely knew each other.
As far as I'm concerned, it would be even more far-fetched if they didn't know each other. Bjelland had worked closely with one of Tor's best friends for years, in the same business, even.
Veronica squinted over at him, as though she still had problems accepting what she'd just been told. A phone started to ring somewhere in the flat. She let it ring, and when it had stopped, she said,
"Well, there's only one thing to do, then."
Henning looked at her.
"Find out what Tore and Charlie were so scared you might discover, and why Bjelland wanted revenge on Tore."
Henning nodded. "I know that Tore probably died because he was going to tell me what he knew about the fire." Henning suddenly looked over at the laptop. "In my flat." He moved over and flipped up the computer screen. The picture of Trina appeared again.
"What is it?"
Veronica asked. Henning tried to gather all the disparate thoughts that were vying for his attention. Trina could actually have been involved in this, in some way or another. That would then explain the warning that had been left on his door. She wouldn't want him, her own brother, to die. But then Tore was sitting outside in a car and took photographs of Trina meeting Durim Redzepi. Photographs that went some considerable way to show that a cabinet minister had something to do with a fatal fire and obviously had links with known criminals.
Henning shared his thoughts with Veronica.
"Just think about it," he said. "Tora was desperate to get out of prison, so desperate that he contacted me and said that he would give me information about the fire in my flat if I could only help clear his name. But even if Tore had still been alive, he would never have told me about a murder that he and Charlie were involved in, because then he might end up with another sentence. And that would just be stupid."
Veronica nodded. Her eyes encouraged him to continue his line of thought.
"But this," he said, pointing at the screen, "this is something else.
Potentially compromising information about Trina, and very relevant information for me. This is what Tore wanted to share with me."
Henning wondered for a moment if that was perhaps why Tore had been killed. But what did the photographs actually prove? That Trina had spoken to a criminal on the street, and that she'd given him something? Trina could easily have talked her way out of it if a newspaper had got hold of the pictures. But the idea that Trina might be involved in such a cunning murder as the liquidation of Tore while in Oslo prison, it was simply too incredible for him to believe. But the photograph showed that Trina had been outside Henning's flat only 10 minutes before it went up in flames, and the fact that she had anything to do with a person like Durim Redzepi was, in itself, suspect. The question was whether she had any dealings with Charlie Highseater as well.
Henning sat back in the sofa. "When is she coming home?" Veronica asked.
"In 3 days' time," Henning replied quietly.
"Well, I have an idea what you might be doing on that day, then," she said.
Henning balled his fists and said, "So do I."
Chapter 4, 3 days later. There was nothing to beat this feeling, Ivar Gunderson thought. Knowing he was about to make a breakthrough, that he and no one else had managed to find a way into the case. And it wasn't just any old case either. That was why he'd left as soon as he'd woken up in Nora's flat. He was itching to discuss his findings with Henning, and had sent him a text message to see if he was up, asking if he could come to his flat as soon as possible. Ivar even offered to pick him up. The answer pinged in moments later. "On my way to the airport. Later today?"
Airport? Ivar thought. What was he doing there?
He replied, "Okay," but he was disappointed. Not long after, there was another ping.
"What's new?"
Ivar thought about what to answer. "Too long to explain by text. Tell you later." Henning said, "Okay." In the meantime, thought Ivar, he could go through it all again to try to be his own devil's advocate, a demanding but necessary procedure for anyone who wanted to blow the lid on something. He had to be 100% certain. Ivar pulled out behind a bus and noticed that he needed petrol. Not surprising, really. He'd practically been living in his car recently. He tried to slow his breathing. He thought about Henning and about Nora. It had been an odd few months. He'd never meant to fall in love with her, but her vulnerability after Jonas's death had made Nora irresistibly beautiful, and he'd almost felt it was his mission to make her smile again. Deep down, Ivar had kind of hoped that Henning wouldn't come back to work, but then he did, one day in late spring, and Ivar wasn't sure which one of them felt most uncomfortable. The first case, the stoning of a film student, Henriette Hagerup, in a tent at Eksberg's Letter, had not helped much either, as Henning had worked out who the killer was and then given Ivar all his information. Ivar couldn't understand why, to begin with, but gradually it dawned on him that Henning was actually protecting himself. He'd known that it was a scoop and would lead to a lot of media attention, and Henning wasn't interested in that. Not then, and not ever. At first, Ivar had loved the furore, but it didn't take long before he felt pretty ambivalent about it all. Every time Henriette Hagerup's name was mentioned, Ivar thought about who actually deserved all the praise. The fact that Henning was the only person who knew didn't make it any easier, which is why Ivar had tried to return the favor. He had thrown himself into Henning's own mystery and the puzzle of Jonas's death with the goal of finding the vital detail, the piece